Saturday with Colm O'Mungon on RTE Radio 1.
Now, you're welcome back, and if you're just joining us, we are looking at the ongoing war in Gaza. Now, there are various figures circulating on the exact death toll in the Strip as the conflict approaches the anniversary of October 7th, but most accepted to be in the region of 41,000, including 16,000 children. Thousands more have been injured, almost 2 million people have been displaced, and they're sheltering in whatever buildings remain standing, but mostly in makeshift camps. Disease and hunger persist with little sign of a ceasefire in sight, and there are fears for what the winter months will bring, and we'll be hearing from UNICEF on that shortly. But first, I've been speaking to the Palestinian ambassador to Ireland, Dr. Jilan Wahba Abdelmajid, and in the weeks after the outbreak of this phase in the conflict, the ambassador revealed she had lost 7 members of her family in Gaza. I began by asking her if the family had suffered further losses.
Let me say that I feel that all the Gazans people are my family. But on a personal level, we have more people that really were killed since the 7th of October, since the first couple of weeks of the 7th of October, during December, January. And I lost as well in the last couple of weeks another cousins. So it has been difficult time, not only for me, but for all the people who have families in Gaza. And I still have family who suffer this displacement and this vicious, brutal war against them. It's part of the whole suffering of the Palestinians who live in Gaza. You know, since the 7th of October, there is no safe place in Gaza. I mean, I was talking to my auntie this morning, which is like she lost her hearings because of this. She's an old lady. This continuous bombardment, moving from one place to another. I couldn't talk to them for the past 3 weeks because there is no telecommunications, and they were moving and displacing from one place to another. This year is coming to an end, and there is no horizon to stop this vicious war.
The best hope seems to be the ceasefire agreement that is on the table at the moment, involving a 6-week ceasefire phased and the release of hostages. In the immediate term, is that what you would like to see happen?
I wanted to see the end of the occupation. I mean, Israel put us during the past year into small details to small details to smaller details. And the main issue is the occupation, is the colonization. This is must end. And we wanted to see a ceasefire. We wanted to rebuild Gaza. Gaza and the Gazans people and the Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank are really resilient, and they wanted to live and rebuild Gaza. We wanted the ceasefire, and we wanted the international community to pressure Israel to agree on this. There are things that the international community must do. The ICJ ruling and the ICC and the General Assembly, the Security Council, but this need to be taken into a different level. Take concrete measures, sanctions. These are the ways that Israel, these are the means that Israel understand and know what it is exactly.
All right. And from the other side, the release of hostages then as well. You want to see that happen?
We wanted, like, our people are the hostages. We have 2.3 million Palestinians live in blockade. There is no water, there is no food, there is no electricity. They are starving to death. This is what we want to see. Hostages from both sides. Yes, the Palestinians are the hostages as well. So when you look at the hostage issue, you look at the Palestinians and you look at the Israelis. We never accepted that, civilians to be taken as a hostage. And we never agree that these hostages or any civilians to be killed. But you have to look at the same times for those 2.3 million Palestinians.
And they are worse off as a result of the incursion since the 7th of October. So strategically, from the point of view of those who represent Palestinians, those attacks by Hamas on the 7th of October have left the Palestinian Authority worse off. More people now support the dissolution of the Palestinian Authority. More people support Hamas. A war has been perpetrated against the people of Gaza as well, in which there have been at least 41,000 casualties. casualties. How do you feel as a representative looking at what has happened, seeing the support of the Palestinian Authority decline and the support for Hamas grow?
I represent all the Palestinians here. I represent the Palestinian Authority, the Palestinian leadership, the PLO, and the State of Palestine. I represent the Palestinian as a whole. And I wanted to say that we need to be united. This is the minute that all the Palestinians should come together and speak in one voice. End this war and end the occupation. We must be united. I mean, Israel weakened the Palestinian Authority, yes, but we still there talk and represent.
But the Palestinian Authority is still giving security cooperation to Israel. Is it even as Israel invades the West Bank, even as it protects settlers who are attacking Palestinians, is there still some security and intelligence cooperation there?
If there is any security cooperation, you wouldn't say the raid, the incursions to the cities and towns in the West Bank. You see that there is Israel started to use the airstrikes, the drones to attack Palestinians. This is because there is no security cooperation. That's why Israel continues.
But in the northern part of the West Bank, there have been areas where the Palestinian security forces couldn't operate because there are militants there who are against the Palestinian Authority as well. Isn't that the case?
The Palestinian Authority in the north and in the south and in the middle of the West Bank to protect the Palestinians. This is the role of the Palestinian security people. And we are there to protect our people. Israel violate all these agreements between the Palestinians and the Israelis. Israel is violating all these agreements and attack the Palestinians. The Palestinians' security are protecting the Palestinian all over the place in the West Bank.
Can I ask you what Ireland can do, what other steps Ireland can take, either in your view within the European Union or on the international stage, to try and help convince other members of the international community to give greater support to Palestinians and exert greater pressure on the international stage to help bring this war to a close?
Ireland played a very leading role, actually, to support the just cause of the Palestinians, whether within the EU, within the European Union, or on the international, the United Nations level. And not today, not since the 7th of October, but even before. And I wanted to say thank you, Irish government, because they were all the time supportive of the justice cause of the Palestinians. We wanted this to end. We wanted the Palestinian people to have their rights of self-determination to be acknowledged and recognized, as Ireland did that by recognizing the State of Palestine. That was a very significant step.
And what difference has it made? I mean, to you in your everyday work, or in terms of people who are speaking to you, Palestinians, what difference has that made?
It make a big difference, even though some people, they said it might be like, you know, not significant, or they said it's just symbolic. No, it means a lot to the Palestinians. This recognition comes at the right time when Israel is now annihilating our people. I mean, they don't want us to be exist. They wanted to uproot the Palestinians from their homeland. And Ireland know that. For me and for my people, it's the recognition, it's the acknowledgement of the right of self-determination of the Palestinian people.
Okay. Ambassador, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And that was the Palestinian ambassador to Ireland, Dr. Gilan Wahba Abdelmajid, speaking to me earlier. We did request an interview with the Israeli ambassador to Ireland, Dana Ehrlich, also, but we were told she wasn't available. Well, I'm joined here now in studio by Peter Power, who's executive director of UNICEF Ireland, and also by Vincent Durack, who's associate professor in Middle East politics at UCD. They've both been listening to the ambassador and indeed our earlier interview with the Taoiseach. Can I begin first with you, Peter Power, and ask you about your most recent briefings about the situation on the ground, in Gaza in particular?
Yes, we've heard from our people only this week. And one of the words they used was the word that the Taoiseach used earlier on, that it is a quite catastrophic situation, a quite desperate situation on the ground now in Gaza, and deteriorating all the time is what we're hearing. Now, these are, I should say, battle-hardened or, you know, crisis-hardened people who've been in Darfur Yemen, Somalia, Afghanistan. But they're saying that Gaza is of a quite different order and magnitude, mainly because it's a completely defined area. It's and everybody's confined in that area. In humanitarian crisis, you often, to some degree or another, not always, but often you have an opportunity to move, to get away from the epicenter. But in Gaza, the people are living with this 24/7 in extremely confined areas where disease is rampant, lack of access to water, sanitation and hygiene is a real issue. And now, of course, we're deeply concerned about the emergence of polio, which is a real problem.
Just in terms of your role and the public communications role on behalf of UNICEF, you mentioned, you know, Sudan and Afghanistan and other conflicts there. It's very rare, though, isn't it, where you have one side and a very senior ally contesting the facts as robustly. The 41,000 people who've been killed that the UN accepts as a figure, the legitimacy even of United Nations refugee organisations, that makes it a very different space in which to operate. So what unique difficulties are presented there?
It's an incredibly difficult, dangerous and complex environment in which to operate. A, because you have to get humanitarian assistance in through various crossings, huge logistical issues around that. But it isn't just a matter of getting aid in over crossings or in the border. You're talking about, you know, food, medicines, tarpaulins, tents, vaccines, as I mentioned. We just got 1.2 million vaccines in last week. But then in this very dangerous environment, you have to move that aid around and deliver it right down to the last mile, last kilometre. And in terms of polio vaccinations, just into the mouths of children. So we welcome the pauses that have been granted for humanitarian pauses for the delivery of these polio vaccines over the course of about 3 or 4 weeks. But to deliver aid on a day-to-day basis, you know, food, water, medicines, it's incredibly
difficult. Why is it slowed to the lowest level yet during the course of this conflict?
Well, it is slowed because the crossings, Rafah crossing is closed, the Kerem Shalom crossing is open, but it doesn't allow aid in at the volume that Rafah was allowing aid in. The Erez crossing, where I crossed in over this time last year, that is open and allowing aid in. But the commonly accepted metric column, and certainly when I was there, there were trucks everywhere delivering supplies and humanitarian assistance in Gaza, about 500 trucks a day. Now it's at the very most, it's 100. And that is very much at the discretion of the IDF.
Right, but it's the job of the IDF under the laws of war to ensure that people over whom it exerts occupation receive this humanitarian aid. We've heard repeated excuses that bandits are robbing aid trucks or it's being corralled off by Hamas. Why aren't the IDF or have they been asked, why are they not ensuring that the aid is reaching the people they are occupying?
Well, in short, that's a question for the IDF. But all we can report as a humanitarian organisation operating on the ground is that aid is getting in, but it's nowhere near the quantities. Like, we have huge amounts of aids on the Egyptian side of the border that is ready and available to get in. And it's up to Israel and the IDF to literally open up the floodgates because it is badly needed. Like, children are going hungry. Polio is now an emerging disease which could have catastrophic ramifications. Diseases, gastro diseases, intestinal diseases, skin diseases, scabies are all real issues on the ground.
A lot of which seems to be to do with water, the inability of people to have a constant source of clean water to wash, to cook and to drink.
Absolutely correct. Water is life, and water is a precious resource in Gaza, and so much of the supply of water has been damaged by constant bombardment. I visited a water desalination plant this time last year, enough to supply 450,000 people. That's not operating anywhere near the level it needs to provide clean water. And when you don't have clean water, respiratory diseases spread, other diseases spread in cramped conditions. But what I would add, Colm, is the IDF also have a responsibility in terms of the evacuation, in terms of the evacuation zones, or the so-called safe humanitarian zones, where people are being told to move to. People have been told you're safe there. And then only this week, there were huge bombs dropped in those very areas. And we would say that is in total disregard. And the Secretary General of the United Nations said that's in total disregard of international humanitarian law. And people need to be held ultimately to account for that.
Right. Vincent Durack, looking at the situation as it pertains in Gaza at the moment, the prospects for a ceasefire, you have people on the ground in Israel, people who are supporting the hostage families protesting against the government, looking for a pause for the release of hostages. You have many in the international community, including almost consensus here in Ireland, looking for a ceasefire for humanitarian reasons on behalf of people in Palestine as well as supporting the release of hostages. But we're very far from that, aren't we?
We're as far as we've been for several months, possibly as far as we've been since pretty much the beginning of the war almost 1 year ago. So you have core, if you like, structural obstacles to any agreement on a ceasefire that have persisted for months now. I mean, it's almost a truism to say that, you know, the Israeli Prime Minister has very clearly a vested interest in the continuation of the war in terms of his personal survival. You've got an enormous division within Israel in terms of any sort of ceasefire proposal. There's, insofar as we can tell, there is very little pressure on Yahya Sinwar, the Hamas chief, to come to an agreement. You know, in a horrific sort of calculation, Hamas are winning this war to some extent in terms of, you know, increased support in the West Bank, in terms of the diminution of the influence of the Palestinian Authority, and the very fact that Israel has not succeeded in, you know, its core war aim of eliminating Hamas militarily and politically constitutes a sort of victory from the perspective, you know, I stress, of Hamas leaders.
But even from within the Israeli government, there is at least an off-ramp, as articulated by the defence minister, Yoav Gallant, and senior military chiefs, who believe that they can get out of what's called the Philadelphia Corridor, the buffer zone between the main part of Gaza and the border with Egypt. They could get out and go back in if they had to, and they could fulfil that part of the ceasefire agreement, have the six-week ceasefire, secure the release of hostages, and who knows what would happen after that. And yet that off-ramp isn't being taken.
Yeah, well, I mean, Gallant has been, you know, relatively speaking, you know, a sane voice in all of this in terms of the current Israeli government. But again, as I think everybody knows now, Netanyahu is also dependent on ministers who represent very far-right constituencies. I mean, including
who've been
one,
described as racist extremists by a former prime minister, Ehud Barak.
Indeed, and Itamar Ben-Gvir has been convicted of supporting terrorism in the past.
He couldn't do his national service because he was a security risk.
He was exempted.
He's the national security minister for
yeah, absolutely.
In Israel.
So for as long as Netanyahu, you know, bows down to pressure from people like Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, you have
the
impossibility
minister, yeah.
Of acknowledging the reality of IDF and intelligence sources who state, as you've done, that the Philadelphia Corridor could indeed be relinquished in terms of its direct control, which would, of course, allow for the possibility at least of a ceasefire deal.
The impact of this hasn't been limited to Gaza. On the West Bank as well, there have been it preceded October 7th, the increase in violence on the West Bank. But since October 7th, around 600 Palestinians have been killed. There have been attacks on Israeli personnel there, but some of the violence being perpetrated by settlers. And you have this strange legal position under the occupation where it's not the job of the IDF to protect Palestinians. Their job there is to protect the settlers. It's the job of the police to police the settlers, and yet many of them are based in settlements. It's not really an investment in calming the West Bank down, is it?
No, not remotely. And I mean, again, for very clear reasons, you know, we are preoccupied to a great extent with the level of, you know, death and destruction in Gaza. But if one were to put that to one side, what's been happening in the West Bank would be the story in Palestine over the last year. I mean, the numbers are relatively small in comparison with the, you know, horrific loss of life in Gaza, but nonetheless you're talking about somewhere around 800 people killed, vastly exceeding anything that has occurred in the course of the last several decades. And that then in turn feeding the delegitimization of the Palestinian Authority, the radicalization of opinion in the West Bank, and of course, a lot of it coming from precisely as you're describing, and as essentially characterizes so much of this conflict, the impunity that's enjoyed by Israeli actors of all kinds, political, military, and others. And the, you know, the so-called hilltop youth, who are, you know, these sort of irregular settlements, as opposed to the other settlements, which are nonetheless illegal under international law.
Right. But although it doesn't take long before irregular settlements are connected to electricity and water and grow. We're going to take a break on this, and after this, we'll be hearing from an Israeli American man whose son was one of the hostages abducted by Hamas on the morning of October 7th.
Saturday with Colm O'Mungon on RTE Radio 1.